And W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.
A Vatican tribunal weighing a financial fraud case has heard from Pope Francis from a secret recording. Jackie Quinn has details.
The broadcast of Pope Francis's own voice in the courtroom marked a new chapter in a trial that's already seen plenty of twists and turns. The conversation was with an accused cardinal over the Holy See's payments to free a nun held hostage by militants. Author and Vatican analyst Marco Politi calls this trial a mess.
Now we don't know whether the Pope has to come as witness in front of the court, which would be unbelievable.
He says
the power struggles within the church have become reckless. There is no more respect for the high authority of the Pope.
Vatican judges are trying to determine who, if anyone, is criminally responsible for losing tens of millions of euros in Vatican assets. I'm Jackie Quinn.
And I'm Ben Thomas, AP News.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The long-term effects of Wisconsin's redistricting process were apparent in the November elections. A nonpartisan good government group says voters who feel overlooked should not give up. Mike Moen reports.
Democratic Governor Tony Evers won re-election, but Republicans maintained strong control over the legislature. Jay Heck of the group Common Cause points out that Evers maintains his veto power, but he says Republicans still carry a lot of weight, partly because they keep redrawing the maps to their advantage.
There were more votes cast for Democratic candidates statewide than Republican, but the contrast with the legislative elections in the state is so sharp, it almost makes laughable the idea that we have a true representative democracy.
Researchers have said that over the past decade, Wisconsin has produced among the most gerrymandered voting district maps in the country. Heck says voters should look ahead to next year's state Supreme Court election with the hope a less politicized court could eventually revisit the issue. And there could be legislation floated again next year to develop an independent redistricting process. In the meantime, he says the current maps allow a smaller percentage of voters to decide who controls the legislature, leaving other voters behind in fair representation.
Urban areas in Wisconsin have suffered a decline in the shared revenue from the state, even though those people pay taxes.
Heck says that means less support for schools, roads, and other public needs. Analysts say lawmakers representing these areas get packed into boundaries that ultimately diminish their voices at the state capitol. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell.
Women hear a lot about self-care these days. Advice on ways to relax, exercise, eat healthy, and more. Those are all great. But one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. That means saving money for retirement. It's never too late to start. And it's the kind of self-care that brings peace of mind that lasts. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. That's WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show, and we are now on the air in Waukesha, live weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m., right here on WAUK 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw. Turn on, tune in, and help us rebuild the American dream. Check out our website at TheRickSmithShow.com. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. Weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m., right here on WAUK 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw.
I'm looking at the phone lines. I'm seeing some familiar faces. Once in a minute, Gene of Eau Claire.
Well, welcome back, Matt. I really miss you. We've been missing getting woke every morning, but now we'll get woke in the afternoon.
Once in a minute, Andrew of Detroit.
Professor, it's so nice you're back. We missed you during your vacation, and I'm very happy to be in your class for the semester.
Thanks a lot for calling in. I appreciate all my callers.
Tune in to Matt Flynn Direct, Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m.
What grows in the forest? Trees? Sure. Know what else grows in the forest? Our imagination, our sense of wonder, and our family bonds grow too. Because when we disconnect from this and connect with this, we reconnect with each other. and build family memories we will carry with us forever. The forest is closer than you think. Find a forest near you and start exploring at discovertheforest.org. It's easy. Just put in your zip code to find family-friendly outdoor destinations near you. You'll also find guides to free activities, games, and amazing forest facts. Give the magic of the outdoors to your kids and reconnect with your family. Find a forest near you at discovertheforest.org. That's discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Finish your high school diploma for you and your family. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome to our second hour here on Morning Cannolis. This morning, as every Saturday morning, doing our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion, our description of the law, government, aspiration for justice stories in our nation. We spent most of the first hour this Saturday morning talking about January 6th. Once again, it is a big week coming up in Washington, D.C., not only because the House Select Committee on January 6th going to have a major hearing on Monday, the last of its 10 hearings in its series begun well over a year ago, but also going to be issuing a major report. Something to read, something to digest, something to analyze, probably making recommendations about new legislation that should come in the wake of January 6th. And also, highly likely, the committee is going to be making some criminal referrals to the Department of Justice. We chatted about the meaning of those, the significance of those, not principally for animating the Department of Justice to charge anyone, but for letting the American public know about the findings and the likely conclusions that one draws from the conduct of various individuals involved in January 6th. As Gene, our caller in the first hour, indicated, the people who are assisting, supporting what happened on that day. A big week coming up. Also a big week for one other significant reason, also on Capitol Hill on Tuesday, unrelated but perhaps in some ways related to January 6th, the House Ways and Means Committee, again a different committee, not the House Select Committee on January 6th, is going to be taking a very significant vote. What are they voting on? They're going to determine whether or not to disclose in part or in whole the former president's tax returns. Remember this issue? The former president had sparred for a long period of time with the House Ways and Means Committee about its request, its subpoena to the Department of Treasury to compel that agency to produce the former president's tax returns, something that virtually every other candidate for the presidency has done in American history. Donald Trump saying no, he would not do that based upon the fact, as he said, that he's under audit, a matter that does not prevent an individual from disclosing them if he wants to do so. But nonetheless, this sparring going on in the courts for many, many years, ultimately going to the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia, ending up at the United States Supreme Court that refused to overturn a Court of Appeals order directing that indeed the tax returns go from the Treasury Department to the House Committee so that it can review those, again, for legislative purposes, for oversight purposes, other legitimate reasons of the House Ways and Means Committee. House Ways and Means, as you well know, responsible for, among other things, putting together a budget every year. This is where our budget begins, according to the Constitution, in the House of Representatives. The House Ways and Means Committee, hugely, hugely powerful, responsible for that activity. This coming Tuesday, going to vote publicly on whether or not some or all portions of those tax returns now in its possession will be disclosed to the American public. needless to say, going to grab more headlines, to be sure, on Tuesday. Not clear we're going to see those tax returns on Tuesday, but a decision by that House committee, again, right now, chaired by a Democrat and populated by a bare majority of Democrats. Plainly, all of this coming to an end at the end of this calendar year when the House of Representatives and the Senate of the 117th Congress comes to an end, and presumably new leadership of the House Ways and Means Committee takes its place in early January. So this important decision on Tuesday about whether or not disclosure will be made of those tax returns, that happening one day after the House Select Committee makes its recommendations to the Department of Justice about criminal referrals, and more importantly, issues its final findings about what happened on January 6th. One other matter that also percolated up this past week in connection with D.C. matters and the attorneys responsible for bringing many of the lawsuits responsible in the courts for those lawsuits challenging the 2020 election. Rudy Giuliani, a sometimes senior advisor to the president, former U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, former mayor of the city of New York, plainly a major figure in American politics, the subject of disciplinary proceedings now in front of the D.C. Bar Disciplinary Council Office. That's the group in the District of Columbia that oversees the credentials, the capacity of people to practice in the District of Columbia. This past week, that D.C. Bar Disciplinary Council recommended to a full committee that the former President Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, be removed from the lists of people who can practice law in the District of Columbia. The office announced this tentative finding during disciplinary hearing this past Thursday, finding that Giuliani had violated ethics rules in the District of Columbia when he filed a 2020 federal lawsuit, among many others nationwide, to prevent the certification of Pennsylvania's election results. So that action prompting the D.C. Disciplinary Council to review that conduct, making a recommendation to the full body that Rudy Giuliani be disbarred based upon that conduct. We know as well that this is not the only place that Rudy Giuliani and others like Jeffrey Clark and John Eastman and Sidney Powell also being the subject of a lot of review by bar counsel, by disciplinary groups looking at the legitimacy of their bars, having filed nationwide these frivolous lawsuits challenging the 2010 results, finally bringing to some, if not clear, resolution. Some resolution to those people who ask, what about the responsibility of lawyers who bring these frivolous lawsuits, knowing that there is no there? Rudy Giuliani having various venues, one in particular notoriously saying, we've got a lot of theories, we just don't have a lot of facts. Well, that gets you into trouble as a lawyer, and indeed this past week, the D.C. Bar Disciplinary Council finding that for saying those kinds of things, bringing lawsuits around the country, including in Pennsylvania, recommending that the Rudy Giuliani's bar license be removed, be yanked from him, if you will, that he be disbarred from his capacity to serve in the future as a lawyer in the District of Columbia. Those things going on in other jurisdictions as well. So lots of things happening this past week, this coming week in the District of Columbia. A programming note, I will comment that on Monday, I'm going to be appearing on this network of civic media late in the day to talk about the results of the committee meeting on Monday. Presumably also talking later in the week about the report, depending upon when it comes out. Its content will be a regular this coming week. Next Saturday, we're not doing a regular presentation of Morning Cannolis, but coming back on January 31st, in a week from this coming Saturday, 2 weeks from today, to do a final wrap-up of significant issues, significant events, occurrences, and actions in the areas, once again, of law, of justice, and government, the rule of law in America. That happening on the 31st of January. We're not having a show this coming, Christmas Eve day on the 24th of January. But again, continuing this hour to talk about yet another major event switching from January 6th and Washington, D.C., although also implicated by conduct by our U.S. Department of Justice. We're going to be talking now for the next hour and some other matters involving cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency. One of the most important things we take away from this is that even though not all of us may understand how cryptocurrency works, the reality is what happened this past week doesn't, and an understanding of what happened does not require an intimate familiarity with that process. So let's get into this with a couple of cases, one of which kind of skated underneath the radar, and another one which took major stage this past week when it comes to cryptocurrency and what has been called one of the defining financial disasters of our time. Let's begin with one of these stories involving a fellow named Carl Greenwood. In 2014, he created something called OneCoin, which was one of these cryptocurrency agencies. Turns out that it was a pyramid scheme that conned billions of dollars from investors worldwide. This past week in New York, in the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of New York, brought by federal prosecutors this past week, Carl Greenwood pled guilty to fraud and money laundering charges brought by prosecutors there. Turns out, in the language of the charges against him, that though this OneCoin cryptocurrency process, this OneCoin agency, was marketed as cryptocurrency, it was never mined using computers, which is a key portion of cryptocurrency processes, and there are no public and verifiable blockchain involved in this as well. The value of OneCoin was not set by supply and demand, but rather by its operators, the prosecutors said. Greenwood, who is 45 years old, was arrested at his island residence in Thailand in 2018, ultimately extradited to the United States, where he pled guilty on Friday in federal court. According to prosecutors, once again, Greenwood's misrepresentations and lies were designed with one goal, and that goal was to get everyday people around the world, including right here in the United States of America, to part with their money, real money, and to line their own pockets to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. That, according to a statement by the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. All of this, a significant portion of the Department of Justice's focus upon cryptocurrency agencies that are, in fact, rifled with and really the products of fraud. This particular defendant, Mr. Greenwood, is going to be sentenced on April 5th. So we'll look forward to that. And that as a way of entry into the other major story having to do with cryptocurrency this past week, and that is the charge of a fellow named Sam Bankman-Fried, facing widespread charges of fraud, being revealed this past Tuesday after the collapse of his cryptocurrency exchange called FTX. He was arrested in the Bahamas this past Monday. I'm going to talk in the remainder of this hour about what those charges are all about, why this is so significant, why the Department of Justice is once again looking at this as a way of addressing the fraud inside this particular cryptocurrency enterprise. Stay with us as we chat about that major fraud and the prosecution now being brought by the Justice Department.
Are you dreading going into work every day? Do you want a career where you can earn more and feel appreciated? If you answered yes, then Sigma Castings, a division of Sigma Engineered Solutions in Marcus Ann and Jackson, is your answer. They are more than a company. They are a family of dedicated experts that span the continents. Here are a few ways they make you feel appreciated. Entry-level pay is $18 an hour with regular performance reviews. After 90 days, you get 80 hours of vacation plus 11 paid holidays. They will give you a $2,000 sign-on, stay-on bonus. They offer a robust benefit package with low premiums and great coverage, and their 401k will blow you away. Now hiring first shift, Monday through Friday, 5 a.m. till 2 p.m. Start your new career today at Sigma Castings in Marquezan and Jackson. Find them on Indeed or call 920-260-8560 and wake up happy to go to work.
What is dedication?
People ask, how your children learn how to ride a bike and you didn't. I just created an environment where they taught themselves and all I had to do was be there.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. A few flurries possible at times this afternoon, otherwise overcast. High temperatures reach up to 20, west winds 10 to 15 miles an hour. Partly cloudy skies tonight, lows level off around 8 above. Overcast skies tomorrow, a few flurries possible at times, daytime highs approaching 25. A dusting of snow tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 16 degrees.
A progressive voice for rural Wisconsin. WAUK 540 AM. Always streaming at WAUKradio.com.
We are back. Thank you for joining me this Saturday morning. As always, taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. This on Morning Cannolis, a show of Civic Media, coming to you this morning as we do every Saturday morning from the studios of WAUK Radio, 540 AM, 101 FM. I'm joined in that studio by my ever-present, wonderfully professional producer, Calvin, taking your phone calls throughout this hour and in the future, down the road as well. In this hour, we're talking about cryptocurrency, the prosecution of one defendant, the major prosecution announced just this past week of a fellow named Sam Bankman-Fried. Sam Bankman-Fried, sometimes referred to the media as SBF. What is the focus of this? Well, Sam Bankman-Fried allegedly defrauded his FTX customers. FTX is the cryptocurrency exchange that he put together and attempting to create, presumably, a cryptocurrency exchange. The allegation against him that he had defrauded those customers by using their funds not to advance the FTX cryptocurrency exchange, but instead for outside investments, things that Bankman-Fried himself was interested in pursuing, costs associated with a sister hedge fund called Alameda Research, a sister much-affiliated hedge fund called Alameda Research, that also presumably in the attention of the Department of Justice, using those monies for costs associated with that group, and also to make tens of millions of dollars in political contributions as a result of this fraudulent activity. That's the basic focus of this allegation, these major allegations, plural, against Sam Bankman-Fried, just announced this past week. Specifically, what do we know about the charges revealed? We know that the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York unsealed this past Tuesday a formal criminal indictment issued by a grand jury charging Bankman-Fried with lying to investors, describing exactly what I've described right here, to form the company and apparently fraud from its very start. Bankman-Fried facing 8 counts, including wire fraud on customers and lenders, conspiring to defraud the United States and to violate campaign finance laws. That's very significant. Keep that in mind for just a moment or so as well. So an omnibus nature of this fraud as alleged in the indictment. U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, a fellow named Damian Williams, said this: "This is our first public announcement, but it will not be our last." He said that at a news conference this past Tuesday, announcing the unsealing of this criminal indictment. Now, why is that significant? Because it indicates plainly that this investigation continues to investigate exactly what Bankman-Fried did. And the reference to campaign finance laws suggests that there may be other people out there, perhaps in our political agencies and political offices around the country who could also be implicated in this either as victims or maybe even as perpetrators. We don't know. But plainly, the use of monies by sent there by investors to invest in this cryptocurrency exchange to support campaigns, some of which are now being returned by some of those campaigns to FTX, all of that, likewise prompting the focus of the U.S. Attorney's Office on campaign finance laws and where these monies may have gone. So that's not an insignificant part of this. In addition to the announcement of this major criminal fraud allegation by the U.S. Attorney just this past week, we also know that the Securities and Exchange Commission, again an agency of the federal government, filed civil charges also on Tuesday, alleging that Bankman-Fried misled investors who had committed about $2 billion with a B, to FTX while also defrauding customers of that exchange, probably paralleling in many ways the allegations in the grand jury indictment. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which plays an important role in overseeing the crypto industry, also filed a complaint against Bankman-Fried, similarly charging him with fraud and misrepresentation. So all these agencies, in addition to the U.S. Attorney's Office, in addition to the Justice Department, charging him with fraud, defrauding customers of the exchange in the ways that I've just described. What happens to Bankman-Fried? Well, he was arrested shortly after 6 p.m. on Monday at his apartment complex in the Bahamas. The timing of that, when he's going to be removed from the United States, was at that point unclear. But the extradition treaty with the United States is in place, could take weeks for that to happen, sometimes longer depending upon the proceedings there and here. But eventually he will be brought back to the United States of America, appearing before a judge there, denied bail by a judge in the Bahamas. So he remains in custody while those extradition proceedings go forward, bringing him back to the Southern District of New York to face not only those charges, but presumably the charges also brought by the Securities and Exchange Commission, by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and by other folks who might be out there, probably civil lawsuits to follow as well. As a part of this as well, the House Committee on Financial Services held a hearing about FTX's collapse, again, this past week. Interestingly, Bankman-Fried was slated to testify before that hearing. Of course, he was not there because he's in the Bahamas. The hearing went ahead without him, and it featured the testimony of a fellow named John J. Ray III. John J. Ray is his name. You may have heard his name in the past. He's responsible. He comes in many of these situations where there needs to be someone who knows about these kinds of things to try to stabilize, if you will, to the extent that can be done, the operation that is now the subject of focus. John J. Ray spent nearly 4 hours testifying before this House Committee on Financial Services, answering questions about what caused the FTX's implosion and the sudden recognition that all of this was built in a house of cards, that the investments made by the investors were, again, based upon nothing. Called an old-fashioned embezzlement by John J. Ray. We'll talk more about that right after this coming break.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
This local musical interlude is brought to you by Max Inc. Radio. Dana Perry. Listen to Max Inc. Radio every Saturday and Sunday, 6 p.m. to midnight. Download the podcast at maxincradio.com. We are local music.
Ready for our little forest adventure?
Yes!
The
There's a forest closer than you think. Find a park or forest near you and music inspired by nature at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by USDA Forest Service and the Ad Council.
AP News, I'm Jackie Quinn. The National Retail Federation says buying was strong today on this Black Friday, and retailers are sensitive to consumers who are feeling the pinch from inflation. Kathleen Cullen is a senior director.
We're hearing from consumers that they are looking for sales and promotions. They are shopping at different brands than they would otherwise, and they're also considering discount stores.
At the Macy's flagship store in New York City, shoppers were back without pandemic restrictions. Our Rita Foley reports.
60% off fashion jewelry, 50% off select shoes, says Macy's. CEO Jeff Gannett says there's significantly more traffic on this Black Friday compared to the previous 2 years because shoppers feel more comfortable in crowds.
Police in Lumberton, North Carolina are searching for a gunman who fired a shot inside a Walmart store today. One person was injured. The Virginia Walmart manager accused of killing six people before killing himself bought the 9mm handgun Tuesday morning, just hours before the massacre. Authorities also say he left a list of grievances on his cell phone. Our Mike Hempen reports.
Andre Bing blamed others for mocking him. Bing also said he did not plan the shooting. Things just fell in place like I was led by the Satan.
Authorities say it was a former student in Brazil who broke into two schools on the same street in Espírito Santo State, killing two teachers and a student today. Some people are traveling home from holiday gatherings. There is snow reported in eastern New Mexico and heavy rains in parts of Texas. COVID cases are back on the rise, and health officials say holiday gatherings could push those numbers above the daily average of 39,000. In World Cup soccer action, once again, the U.S. ends with a draw against England. This is AP News.
This is Pat Greitlow from Up North News Radio. On the air, online, or on demand, make it a point to catch the first word on Wisconsin news, sports, and more weekday mornings from 6 to 8 all across the stations of the Civic Media Radio Network.
Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian.
I'm really trying hard not to go insane from the mind screw that is this situation. Yes. With I was going to say the GAB, but now it's the WEC, which is audited by the LAB, and then it's now screwed up by the GOP. We're all SOL. Good for us. Congratulations.
Look at all those acronyms. Yeah.
We're the winners.
Tune in for Dueling Tangents every weekday at 2.
I'm 54, so it's too late to start saving for retirement, right?
Not right. Starting to save, even in your 50s, can really make a difference. At aceyourretirement.org, in just 3 minutes, you'll get a free, personalized retirement plan. That's aceyourretirement.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
The Shaw 101 FM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
We're talking about this major so-called old-fashioned embezzlement case that has been brought against Sam Bankman-Fried, the fellow who is responsible for initiating and operating fraudulently this thing called the FTX cryptocurrency exchange. And right before the break, I was talking about the appearance for the new chief executive of FTX. His name is John Ray, brought in to try to clean up the mess, if you will, presented by the massive fraud that he has already identified. Repeatedly, he has been asked to compare the collapse of this company to another famous failure that Ray also came in to clean up, and that is the Enron matter. Remember Enron from many years ago? Ray said before the committee this past week that they're very distinct disasters. Oh, they described both of them as financial disasters. He said the perpetrators of Enron's crimes were highly sophisticated, whereas the FTX executives are simply engaged in what he called old-fashioned embezzlement. Nonetheless, he described a complete lack of record-keeping, complete lack of basic fiscal operations, kind of horrified, if you will, by what he saw. Now responsible for trying to straighten some of this out. The company, needless to say, also in bankruptcy. indicated before the break. Likewise, also involved with the SEC and with the Commodities Futures Trading Commission as its woes are further identified going forward here. Lots of things to take a look at. Lots of things are going to be the subject of great focus here. The SEC in particular, its Division of Enforcement, described FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried as a house of cards that began to crumble this past May. In remarks before the media just this past Tuesday, the director of the SEC's Division of Enforcement, Gurbir Grewal, said that FTX operated behind a veneer of legitimacy, giving Bankman-Fried and others this capacity to solicit, obtain monies, that he created this company, but repeatedly touted risk controls and claimed that the assets were safe when, in fact, all of this was false and fraudulent. Huge amount going on here. Now, you may well ask, well, gee, why is it that if this matter is being prosecuted in the Southern District of New York, how is it that FTX and Bankman-Fried are based in the Bahamas? And why is it that again, the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York is the one who's doing this? Well, there are a number of different possible reasons for that. This is the moment of civics inside this particular prosecution. We'll find out more about this, but the simple answer is that some part of the activity that prompted the accusations that took place within the Southern District of New York happened there, probably including Manhattan, the Bronx, maybe some of the adjacent counties. So some of these activities, even though FTX and Bankman-Fried located physically, geographically located in the Bahamas, some of those activities probably took place in New York. In this case, for example, prosecutors might be able to show that some wire transfers went through Manhattan-based banks, for example. Or, for instance, that people agreed to the conspiracy while in the district. That's another basis for locating the prosecution in the Southern District of New York. Or it could be that customers in the district were defrauded. All sorts of bases upon which you could could locate the prosecution in New York City and the Southern District of New York in particular. Of course, the centrality, as we know, of New York as the global financial headquarters has always given the Southern District of New York an advantage when it comes to prosecuting these kinds of financial crimes. It will not be difficult to establish a basis there in the Southern District of New York for some of these events having happened, given all of those various theories that right now, again, part of my speculation, but unless likewise going to be disclosed during the coming weeks and months as this case goes forward. So once again, a huge, huge prosecution revealed this past week of this fellow Sam Bankman-Fried and his cryptocurrency exchange FTX, an old-fashioned embezzlement, simply taking in monies from investors, using it not for the cryptocurrency purpose, but for many other purposes, including political advancement and political contributions. A lot to watch there. An awful lot of people thinking this may well be the Enron of our time. So we'll continue to monitor that as it comes out of the Southern District of New York and presumably these other agencies as well. Let's leave the East Coast and come to the Midwest and talk about two other significant prosecutions going forward in two different venues, two different ways. Significantly, you recall that this past September in Highland Park in northern Illinois, a fellow named Robert Cremo was accused of killing seven people at the 4th of July parade in Highland Park. That horrific event, very much a part of our national attention when that happened. You may recall well that the accused gunman in Highland Park pled not guilty, awaiting trial at this point. The evidence certainly indicates up to this point that Robert Cremino had climbed onto the roof of a building there during an Independence Day parade and began firing fairly indiscriminately with a high-powered rifle, wounding dozens and killing seven people in that melee that followed. Just a horrific event, much in our attention nationally. Why is this back in the news? Well, it turns out that now, just this past week, the prosecutors in that Chicago suburb of Highland Park have charged the father of Robert Cremo with his his involvement in that event. Seven counts in particular of reckless conduct filed against the father, also named Robert Cremo. They mark at least the second time in recent years, by my calculation, that a parent of an accused mass killer has faced charges of this sort for their actions leading up to attack. Could also signal, of course, an increased willingness by prosecutors to seek punishment by family members who might have been involved and somehow ignored warning signs or otherwise provided access to weapons. The top prosecutor in Lake County, where this matter is pending, said this past week. He said, people bear responsibility when they recklessly endanger others. These offense conduct carries a sentence of up to 3 years in prison. And the prosecutor, a fellow named Eric Reinhardt, said specifically that the father knew about a series of concerning episodes involving his son before he signed the gun application permit that endorsed the application. And that event, of course, that engagement, that action was reckless, leading to the seven counts of reckless conduct premised, obviously, upon the seven people who were killed. I made reference just a moment or so ago to this notion that others who are involved, who know about the threat posed by family members, who may do something to aid or abet or advance the conduct, are now being increasingly focused on in connection with charges. This Illinois charge follows this new playbook that was also tested in Michigan, if you will, where the parents of a teenager who pleaded guilty to killing classmates at Oxford High School last year were charged with involuntary manslaughter. You may recall that as well. Prosecutors in that venue, in that instance, said that they filed those charges because the parents allowed their son access to a handgun while they at the same time ignored warnings that he was on the brink of committing exactly the violence that he did at Oxford High School. The parents, whose names are James and Jennifer Crumbly, pleaded not guilty and are awaiting trial in that case. Back in Highland Park, the community, of course, responding again to the horror of what happened back in September, now reminded of this by virtue of the charges being brought by the father of the shooter for his involvement and once again signing the gun application and endorsing that application, bringing him likewise into the criminal justice system. A significant use of the criminal law to sweep in those people who are responsible for engaging in that kind of criminal behavior. And then speaking again of Michigan, let's talk about this other case that we have discussed on Morning Cannolis in this broadcast in the past. You may recall this attempt to take the life of the governor, Gretchen Whitmer, by this group of conspirators who planned to kidnap her and kill her back in 2020 before the FBI broke up that scheme to violently kidnap her and kill her. Well, this past Thursday, a judge handed down the longest prison terms so far in that plot to kidnap Michigan's governor and as a part of that plot. Specifically, in the wake of the convictions of three of them, one of them was sentenced to a minimum of 12 years in prison, another one 10 years in prison, and yet a third 7 years in prison. They will be eligible for parole after serving those terms, but not until serving the complete terms in the state of Michigan. Speaking in a recorded video as a part of this sentencing process, Governor Gretchen Whitmer, again, who would have been the victim, the intended victim of this horrific event, this horrific attempt to kidnap her, encouraged the judge to, as she said, impose a sentence that meets the gravity of the damage they have done to our democracy. Talking more, not just about the impact upon her and the possibility that she could have been kidnapped, possibly killed, she said this: a conspiracy to kidnap and kill a sitting governor of the state of Michigan is a threat to democracy itself. And she added that she now scans crowds for threats and worries about the fate of everyone near me. The judge imposing this sentence upon those additional defendants had presided over the first batch of convictions in state court, following, again, this very high-profile series of trials that took place. Four others in federal court, fellows named Fox and Barry Croft were described as the captains of this quite incredible plan to snatch the governor from her vacation home, and were seeking to inspire a civil war known as the Boogaloo. Again, that being brought closer to some resolution in Michigan just this past week, bringing to justice these people who are attempting to kidnap the governor, and so perhaps as a part of their scheme, try to incite a national conspiracy, a civil war, plainly a ridiculous notion, but nonetheless now being brought to justice there in Michigan. We've got a caller who's calling in from Maribak. Jack, glad to have you with us this morning on Morning Cannolis.
Good morning. I would take a cannoli if you have one.
Well, visit us sometime, and my wonderful producer, Calvin, and I will make sure that happens here. But go ahead, Jack, with your comment or question. Jack, are you still with us this morning? I hope so. If not, we'll continue with some discussions of other matters, but hoping that, Jack, you'll stay with us and join us again whenever you can to articulate your question or comment. Jack, apparently there just briefly, and perhaps coming back at some point down the road. So those important things happening, again, in Illinois and Michigan just this past week. Let's go back once again to the Supreme Court. We've talked a lot about things having to do with Supreme Court cases coming up in the past and in the future. The Supreme Court has finished for this year its oral arguments, a number of them we've talked about on this very broadcast, and is already scheduled arguments coming up in the month of January, January 9th, the 10th, the 11th, the 17th, and the 18th, all of those days on which our United States Supreme Court is going to be conducting oral arguments on some of the cases that we have discussed here on Morning Cannolis in the past. As a part of our continuing review of cases being presented to the United States Supreme Court, in January, we'll talk about some new cases now on the docket of the United States Supreme Court. To this point, to this morning of December 17th, the Supreme Court has accepted 50 different cases. It has granted certiorari, which is the legal way of saying send to us, the record of lower courts, in about 50 different cases, including various things that we're going to be discussing in January. Also significant that as a result of its return to business in January, it's going to be returning to the tradition that it conducted, pursued prior to the pandemic, of announcing its decisions in court. And so we're looking forward to that perhaps in the new year, certainly in May and June, returning to in-court announcements of its opinions and also, of course, conducting further oral arguments. Come back for our final few moments here on Morning Cannolis right after this break.
Blood is the rose of mysterious union. Dead blood in the streets, it's up to my ankles. Blood in the streets, it's up to my knee. Blood in the streets, the town of Chicago.
Women hear a lot about self-care these days. Advice on ways to relax, exercise, eat healthy, and more. Those are all great. But one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. That means saving money for retirement. It's never too late to start. And it's the kind of self-care that brings peace of mind that lasts. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. That's WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
I'm Pat Kreitlow from Up North News. On an earlier edition, we talked to three women, med students, about whether they're going to stay in Wisconsin to practice medicine.
All this Roe v. Wade stuff, and now OBGYN's hands are so tied. I don't want to go through 12 years of training to have some person that didn't do training tell me how to do my job.
It is not a binary choice. You're for or against abortion. It is a healthcare decision. We all have those stories, and people want to hear them.
Don't miss the real stories here on Up North News.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hey, son. How are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. A few flurries possible at times this afternoon, otherwise overcast. High temperatures reach up to 20, west winds 10 to 15 miles an hour. Partly cloudy skies tonight, lows level off around 8 above. Overcast skies tomorrow, a few flurries possible at times, daytime highs approaching 25. A dusting of snow tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 16 degrees.
Bringing some sanity to the airwaves. The Shaw 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM.
Of the Trump Organization were convicted in state court for criminal tax fraud, charges of conspiracy and falsifying business records. Sentencing of the corporation scheduled for January 13th. The defense already saying it's going to appeal that conviction of December 6th. Again, that tax fraud case involving, you may recall, Ellen Weisselberg, the CFO, testifying about these tax improprieties by the Trump companies. Why is this back in the news? Well, it turns out that during the course of that investigation and the oversight of that matter by the judge who is presiding over the case, the Trump Organization was secretly held in contempt for hindering the probe of that matter. Specifically, the finding revealed this past week that the Trump company impeded a grand jury investigation by repeatedly failing to turn over evidence in a timely fashion, leading to a secret contempt finding, again, not disclosed, and a $4,000 fine, according to some records that were finally made public this past Tuesday. The matter is significant because it adds yet another wrinkle in this continuing focus of the Trump Organization there in Manhattan. We know as well that the state attorney general, Letitia James, continues to pursue her civil matter. This, again, coming out of the criminal matter in which the Trump Organization, at least two of them, were found guilty. A finding of contempt, even while the investigation of that going on, for failure to turn over evidence in that case. Then we also have Steve Bannon back in the news. You may recall well that Steve Bannon was charged in September of this year for his role in a group that had raised millions of dollars promising to build a private wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, allegedly pocketed funds instead. You may recall as well that the U.S. Department of Justice had initially charged him with that same offense, and Steve Bannon had been pardoned by the former president, and therefore that prosecution, that federal prosecution, brought to a conclusion. Well, it turns out that the state of New York decided to charge him in violation of state law in that jurisdiction, and in the connection with that matter, the judge has recently scheduled his trial to go forward in November of 2023. That judge, his name is Awan Mershan, and he said that that trial will, in fact, proceed in November of 2023. All of that significant because of the continuing matters of Steve Bannon and his involvement in that case there. So we now have that trial date in November of 2023. Steve Bannon maintaining that these charges against him are political cases. His attorneys saying they wouldn't have been brought if they weren't political cases. It's like the elephant in the room. You're not allowed to talk about it, but there's a reason why this case was brought, claiming once again that it's premised upon politics and not the evidence that prompts these prosecutions. Plainly going to be the subject of that prosecution, that trial coming up in November of 23. We will continue to monitor that as well in front of Awan Mershan, again, the judge presiding over that case. And finally, yet another matter that we have not talked about before. but also a federal lawsuit accusing former President Donald Trump and his family of promoting a pyramid scheme is going to go to a trial on January 29th of 2024. At the start of what plainly, as we all know, is the start of a presidential election year. This is a lawsuit, again, we haven't chatted about it before, brought anonymously in October of 2018. This one alleging that the Trump Corporation promoted a multi-level marketing scheme, kind of a pyramid scheme, through a company called ACN Opportunity LLC. It operates under the name American Communications Network, Law, and so forth. This lawsuit brought in October of 2018, four plaintiffs in that particular case bringing these charges in a federal court, specifically alleging that Trump and members of his family should be held liable for lending that Trump and his children engaged in. This pyramid scheme that broke state and federal laws around a racketeering and conspiracy to racketeer charges alleged in that case. The Trump family, according to the allegations in that case, falsely endorsed and promoted ACN by insisting that this enterprise, according to the claim in this case, offered a reasonable probability of commercial success and even embedded advertisements on the show, but the Celebrity Apprentice, which was on the airwaves at that time. In exchange, they allegedly received millions of dollars in secret payments. Again, all this according to this federal lawsuit brought against the Trumps in a federal court. The lawsuit also goes on to say that the Trump family's promotion of ACM encouraged the plaintiffs to invest hundreds of dollars into the company, but they never reaped any benefit from that investment. That trial, again, going forward in January of 2024, again, significant because it is the start of the presidential election year. We know that the former president has announced that he is a candidate for the presidency and presumably will be campaigning at that time. As we begin to conclude our hour, we do have Jack back from Merrimack. We'll take him right now. Jack, briefly, your comment or question as we begin to conclude our conversation this morning.
Yeah, thank you for taking me back. I apologize. Out here next to Lake Wisconsin, sometimes I've got to move a bit to get decent reception.
I understand. Anyway, go ahead, Jack, your comment or question.
My question is, if they can hold liable the parents of some of these kids that allowed the kids to take part in these mass shootings, what about people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, who clearly have encouraged violence against political figures, like, for instance, the governor of Michigan? Can't they be held liable technically for criminal incitement or something similar?
And Jack, you know, you raise a very, very important point. You know, the question is enticement, right? Incitement to violent conduct. Certainly there have been civil cases and some criminal cases out there where that theory has been advanced. And the kind of thing that as we look to more of these cases should be the focus of prosecutors, certainly civil folks as well, and the victims of these kinds of crimes. Appreciate very much the comment this morning, Jack, from Merrimack, as we think about other theories. And we're going to conclude now our morning presentation here of Morning Cannolis. Remember, this coming week on Monday and perhaps on Wednesday as well, I'm going to be back on the radio broadcast of Civic Media talking about the January 6th House Committee meetings. Stay with us for that this coming week. Have a good weekend, everybody. We'll talk with you again very soon.
Hey, this is Matt from Design Garden. Remember when the internet was new? Back then you had to leave your house to start a business. Companies used to pay programmers bags of cash to get online. Now, small businesses can get online with a Facebook business page, or Squarespace, or Google My Business, or WordPress. But which tools should you use? Can you afford to go down the wrong path? Design Garden uses modern tools to build your website the right way. Find us online at design.garden. Again, that's design.garden.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
Up North News Radio is Wisconsin's new choice for progressive talk about important state issues. From the team that brings you the news through social media, newsletters, and here on the radio. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Join me weekday mornings from 6 to 8 a.m.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.